Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today we're sitting down with Andre Novoa, creator and owner of Games Omnivorous, to talk about publishing TTRPGs and designing their latest game, The Job, which is currently crowdfunding on BackerKit. Andre, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Thanks so much. Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, it's so good to have you here. I've been a fan of your work for a while. Games Omnivorous, you make beautiful stuff. Like the feel and the sight of all of it is just always something I'm excited to see.
So, oh, thanks so
fun
much.
To talk to you.
Thanks so much.
But today we want to have you on to talk specifically about The Job, which is this game that is crowdfunding right now in a cool ass box set that people can grab on BackerKit. And then we want to kind of use that to get into Games Omnivorous and your work making these minimalist and art house games and kind of what you've got planned for the future. But first up, for anybody listening who might not be aware, can you just tell us what The Job is?
The Job is my take on the heist genre, so my iteration of what an RPG and a heist RPG could be like. That's essentially what it is. So it's more story driven, leaning into the narrative kind of genre within RPGs. It's a very cinematographic styled RPG. Role-playing game, so it's and players play the part of a crew trying to steal a location and kind of relive as a player. You kind of relive that experience of watching movies like Ocean's 11 or The Italian Job. So that's kind of what the game is and what it tries to do, essentially.
There's a great thing that you do in the we saw a little preview of the text, and immediately on the credits page you list a bunch of movie influences, and it's like, if you didn't know what it was going to be like to play this game and you saw that list of movies, it's like, oh, all right, I know what we're doing here.
Yeah, it's like it's something that I've grown very fond of. When I pick up a book, a new game or a rule set, and it kind of lists the influences, both in terms of media, literature, movies, or even other games that it draws inspiration from. That kind of sets the tone and sets my expectations for what I'm reading. So I absolutely, that's something that I'll continue to do.
It is really helpful. And I think especially seeing, you know, you look at the list of the movies, you're like, okay, I get the vibe. I got Logan Lucky, I got Inside Man, I've got Ocean's 11, I've got Lupin. But then you also look at the acknowledgments for the games, and you see Honey Heist, you see Fiasco, you see 10 Candles, and I'm like, and you see Dread, and I'm like, oh, okay, mm-hmm. I haven't read the game. I'm pretty sure I know the vibe and general mechanics of the game.
Exactly. That's exactly why why I decided to put that info there. So, yeah.
And I think it's worth looking at the first influence you have on here, which is Fiasco. Because The Job is taking a similar route to what Fiasco did, in that it started as a book and now is expanding to this box set with a bunch of extra mm-hmm. stuff within the box. Why was that the right move for The Job? Why was that interesting to you?
Well, not to compare myself with or The Job with Fiasco, which is like one of the biggest hits in the world, right, in role-playing games. But I think, yeah, it was kind of like a coincidence, really. But I think that The Job started as very much an experimental work or creation for myself and with the people that I work with here at Games Omnivorous, because it's not normally what we do or what we kind of been known for. I think that people and the people who are our clients and our fans and the people who play our games have grown accustomed to a more traditional approach and more like the old school renaissance or the new school revolution, whatever you want to call that.
Yeah.
We're mostly known for games that are within that corner of the industry, like Mouse Raider, for instance, or Vaults of Varn, or Frontier Scum even, which started as kind of like a hack of Morkborg. And obviously, we are also known for these kind of like system agnostic supplements as the Undying Sands, Bottled Sea, or even the Hack Scroll Toolbox. And these are system agnostic settings and supplements that people can play with the more traditional or OSR kind of games, right? So the job really deviates from them. And it's kind of like my take on the more narrative and story-driven kind of approach to game design. So it was, yeah, I was telling you that it was very experimental work within Games Omniverse. And so we did a very limited print run in the start. So it was only, I think, 500 books printed because I really didn't know how people would react to something that kind of deviates from what we normally do. But my idea was, even then, right from the start, my idea was to eventually make a box set out of this. I just didn't want to commit from the start because I didn't know what sort of response we would get out of this game. But yeah, then we released the first edition, which was just the book, and it gained a lot of traction. So I received a lot of messages that people were having a great time playing this game. I remember receiving an email from a store in Copenhagen, and they were like, oh, do you have more books? We want to buy more books. And we're like, yeah, well, we're out at this point, because it kind of sold out pretty quickly. And I remember I replied to them saying, oh, no, we don't have any more, but we're planning something. They're like, oh, it's a shame, because we have like a group of people that plays this game weekly here at our store and stuff like that. So it's kind of like picked up. And then I already sold the rights to translation to Spanish, French, Italian. So it's a game that is kind of expanding. And then, yeah, Exalted Funeral came along. I met Exalted Funeral. I met them in person. Although we've been working for 5 years now together, I've only met them last year at PAX Unplugged. So we were I went there. I ran some Mouse Raider games at their booth, and we did a bunch of promotion and things. And then we were just hanging out when we started talking. And I remember Kristen and Matt were like, "Oh, maybe we should do another version, another edition of the job." And I was like, "Yeah, absolutely." I was thinking about doing it for some time now. And then they tagged along, and it eventually evolved into this box set with all sorts of content. So it has reusable character sheets, it has a fillable plan sheet, it has briefing notepads, and hopefully as the stretch goals get unlocked, we will have a ton more content inside the box set with expanded adventures and stuff like that. But to answer your question, I mean, I kind of visualized the box set right from the start. I mm-hmm. just didn't want to commit. And now it's like everything came together. So we're doing it now.
I love that.
Hell yeah. And you said, so you mentioned that like this is a sort of different game design area for you from what people have come to expect. Let's talk a little bit about like how you've mechanized story, like this kind of more story forward game in your own way. I love this like central dice stacking mechanic. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. One of the central aspects of this game is the dice stack, as you were saying, Elliot. And it's obviously, it draws inspiration from games like Dread with the Jenga Tower. That's where the inspiration came from. And it's a central element. It's something that basically, as players miss their rolls or fumble their rolls, they have to start stacking dice, physically stack dice on the gaming table. And then when the dice collapses, something happens. And then players start building a new tower, but they have to stack two dice instead of just one. And then if the tower collapses again, something else happens. And then there's a third and final stack, and they have to stack three dice on top. And it collapses very quickly by the end, which really emulates this idea of tension and things kind of escalating quickly. And if the stack falls three times, the heist ends. So my approach to coming back to your question is I at a certain point, I was playing a lot of these more story-driven narrative games, as you were saying, like Blades in the Dark or Apocalypse World or even Fiasco at some point, Dread and Candles, these sorts of games. And there were two things, in my view, that I kind of missed from that experience. One was having, I kind of felt like having a winning condition at some point was something that would be very cool, mm-hmm. which is something that most of these games do not bring. And I think that The Job does that well, because there's clearly a goal, there's clearly a winning condition, unlike in most role-playing games. So you either can pull off the heist or you lose trying. And mm-hmm. and losing is, I've played this game extensively by now, and losing is sometimes even funnier than actually pulling it off. It's like it goes down in a catastrophic blaze, and it's really, really cool. It's even more memorable in some occasions than actually pulling off the heist. So one thing that I missed from these more narrative games that you were seeing was this kind of like winning condition, this thing that kind of clearly defined and had a goal for the players. And the other thing that I kind of miss when I'm playing these games is a bit more structure.
Sure.
I come from the like OSR, whatever, NSR world, right? Where normally the GM runs a dungeon or a model for the players, right? There's an adventure, a pre-written adventure, and you pick it up. Like, I think my favorite game is probably Dungeon Crawl Classics, and they have these awesome modules that come in books with 20 or 30 pages, so they're fairly small. But even in Mouse Reader, which is fairly open-ended, we still offer you like a little pamphlet or a little postcard with a dungeon that you can run for your players. Mm-hmm. And with the more story-driven and narrative games, I kind of miss that. I'm not a very good referee or GM to be constantly improvising upon, you know, on top of improvisation. So sometimes it's kind of hard for me to really move the story forward without having some sort of structure. So in this game, in The Job, what I tried to do to compensate for that was to create a phase in the game, which is the preparation phase, before we move on to the dice stack and all that, which is in the action phase. There's a preparation phase, which takes about an hour and a half, at least in my playtest, that's what it took, where the players actually write down in a plan, in a piece of paper, their heist and the 12 scenes that they want the GM to run for them. So in a way, they're kind of preparing their own dungeon, or they're kind of preparing their own module, their own session of play. And that, I think, was very cool when I was playtesting, that it really felt like the players were preparing a heist as their characters. It simulated their that experience. So it takes like an hour and a half, and players write down 12 scenes. And the book offers some structure on this. So the first two scenes are about infiltration. The next four scenes are about deployment. Then there's execution, and then there's the escape. Mm-hmm. And the game offers you, when the GM tells you what you're going to rob and the object and the location, the referee also gives you six complications that you must include in this plan. So it's kind of like, you know how good art, people say that great art comes from big constraints. It's kind of like that. So you kind of set boundaries for the players or limits to work as like a catalyst of imagination or creativity. So that's what I tried to do. So you have these six known complications. For instance, it can be motion sensors, security cameras, alarms, or even more bizarre things like tigers or dogs or whatever you want to include, right? So players write these scenes, and these scenes can be as small as just one sentence, like crew member A is approaching the front desk and try to manipulate the security guard into walking into the building disguised as a janitor, whatever, you know, that is the scene. So players write these 12 scenes, and then they hand it over to the referee, and the referee is going to run that module for them. And obviously then the book gives you lots of tools and ideas on how to complicate that, on what to do when players fumble rolls or fail rolls. And yeah, that's how the game works.
Essentially. The preparation phase was the first thing that I really keyed into of something that I hadn't really ever seen in a role-playing game before to this extent. And the thing that I was most excited about this game, because you're very right. It's like their players are writing their own module, which is like the thing we talk about kind of in the abstract in like a session zero, where like, listen to what your players want and just give them what they want and you're all going to have a good time. This is literally players write down the exact thing you want. And guess what? Exactly. That is exactly what we're doing with this session, which is great. And also in just the fulfillment of the fantasy of this world, of the heist fantasy, if you've seen Ocean's 11, there's the scene where they all meet at the house and they show you, you know, the Bellagio, the Mirage, the MGM Grand. Here's how we get in. Here's how we do it. This immediately fulfills that aspect of the fantasy of the, all right, let's all get in a room. Let's plan it out. Here's our schematics. Here's our plan. And then the best part of any heist movie is, you show the plan, you do the plan, and there's a bunch of fucking shit that gets in the way.
Exactly.
As you're trying, it exactly encapsulates that format in a way that it feels almost inevitable that you will tell a great heist story because the game has so properly sculpted those expectations.
That's exactly what we tried to do. Like, these movies have these tropes, as you were saying, which is like kind of, they have a preparation phase. Also, right, where they're planning the heist and telling what they're going to do. And it really feels like, I think, or at least during playtest, that's what I got from the players, that they designing their own models really feels like that first part of a good heist movie.
Yeah.
And then, as you were saying, they move on to the action phase. And of course, that the plan doesn't go as they thought it would. And also the game emulates that. So I think it's an interesting game that does a very specific thing, but I think it does it well. It's very cinematographic in that sense. Yeah.
It's interesting that you've kind of created like two games that happen here. One is like a GM-less game, and then you have a version where the GM steps in. Like the GM-less game, we get to like be like, here's what happens if like our heist goes perfect, and then the GM steps in. Why? Like, because some of the, actually, not all of the influences, but some of the influences you have are GM-less games. Why was it important to you that this like actual play of the game has a referee, has a GM that comes in to sort of taking that role?
It's a good question. Excellent question. I don't know that I needed it. It just felt natural for me to have a referee. And I think it's more fun if there's actually somebody running the heist for you and then adding complications and unexpected trouble to that for you, so that this talk, this conversation is a bit more interesting than just the players, working against a book or rule book, you know what I mean? So it just felt natural for me. And it's just how I normally play. Or I like to play role-playing games. I'm not a huge fan of GM-less games myself. I don't know why. It's just something that it never really spoke to me. So for me, it's very natural. It was a very natural choice. It wasn't something that I really thought much about. It just came natural that it was this way. And I think it works well. It works well.
Midnight Muscadines is a cozy, dark tabletop role-playing game where light and shadow intertwine in a fractured world. Players take on the roles of Marmiteers, brave adventurers who journey into the untamed wildernight to collect the elusive Midnight Muscadines, craft magical jams, and protect the fragile light of Nim. Through collaborative storytelling and resourceful gameplay, players weave tales of courage, community, and the pursuit of balance. Will you preserve the light, uncover the truths hidden in the shadows, or reshape the balance of the world forever. Midnight Muscadines is perfect for fans of Studio Ghibli and Sea of Stars who seek to capture the magic of exploration and the heartfelt adventure in a world where small heroes make a big impact. Play Midnight Muscadines as a traditional GM'd game, GM-less, or even solo. Midnight Muscadines is crowdfunding now on Backerkit. Join the campaign at pandeongames.com/muscadines.
I'm Quinns of tabletop role-playing game review show Quinns Quest, and this is Play to Find Out. Play to Find Out is an actual play podcast that brings notorious old games from the 80s and 90s back to the table. Each season of Play to Find Out, I'm joined by Emily Johnson and Rob Morgan.
Good? Nervous?
Yeah.
You both looked at each other really concerned, like you think what's about to happen is going to be unpleasant. And frankly, I think that's rude. And together, we explore the TTRPGs of ages gone by. Our goal? To separate the TTRPGs that deserve to be remembered from those that maybe don't.
Can I
don't know, Emily. It was the 80s. A lot of people were on cocaine. We blow the dust from decrepit systems to learn how they work.
Your 100 on the encounter table bursts out. Right, you've encountered a bug. Get ready. Don't laugh.
How does one get ready for a bug?
Don't laugh.
Encounter their unique quirks.
I do finger guns to cover up how I wince.
A weird thing happens as you do finger guns.
Oh, no.
And I'm hoping that the Quinns Quest community will join us in exploring these games too. If you this up, cannot describe to you how much your adventure ends here.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because the best way to learn is to play to find out. Play to Find Out is available now on the Quinns Quest Patreon, but the first episode of each series streams for free on the Quinns Quest YouTube channel and wherever you get your podcasts. Anyway, you failed the Earth Tech roll, and you made jokes while I was doing my exposition, so you don't get to hear any more.
No. Come on.
I was shook.
Hey everyone, this is Brian, and I just want to tell you about a great one-shot actual play that we're releasing on May 12th over on My First Dungeon. It's for a new TTRPG called Mad as Hell, and it's sponsored by our good friends over at Soul Muppet Publishing. Mad as Hell is a new anti-capitalist demon-hunting game where you play as radicals who fight the literal demons of capitalism. But what makes Mad as Hell different is that the demons you're fighting aren't just destroyed when you beat them. In order to destroy them forever and to stop them from coming back, your radicals will have to spend time in their communities making meaningful social change to correct the injustice that created that demon in the first place. So tune into My First Dungeon on May 12th to hear our one-shot of Mad as Hell. But in the meantime, Mad as Hell is currently crowdfunding over on Kickstarter, so head over there and consider backing the game and supporting some of our favorite people making some of our favorite games.
Can you talk to me a little bit more about the inventory system for this game? Because I think it is really interesting in that there's such a resource management element to this role-playing game.
So yeah, another great question. I think that in terms of the characters and what they do, because there's this preparation phase that is kind of, it takes time, and it obviously needs a lot of interference from the players. I kind of replaced character creation with that, mm-hmm. in a sense. So character creation in this game is virtually non-existent. You're handed over a role. It ranges from being like the boss to the con artist or the pickpocket or the wheelman or the greaseman. So the bruiser, and there's a weird one, which is the animal handler, but it's super fun. It's really super fun to roleplay that one. So I kind of replaced the idea of character creation, because characters in this game don't even have stats, like strength or charisma or whatever. They don't have stats. They're simply defined by four stunts, which they can pull off during the heist. Stuff like, for instance, I think one of my favorite is the Bruiser. So the Bruiser can actually blow, physically the player can blow on the dice stack. And if any dice fall from the stack, those are removed kind of from the game. So the stack kind of de-escalates. So it kind of represents de-escalating the fiction in a way. But so I kind of, as I was saying, I kind of did this thing where character creation is virtually non-existent because the preparation phase already is very demanding of the players. So I didn't want to tax them with, you know, more rules to create the characters, and, you know, you have to spend another 20 or 30 minutes creating characters. No, you just go straight to planning the heist, which means that the focus for the characters is precisely on these four stunts that they can pull off and the inventory, as you were saying. And players only have access to four pieces of equipment during the heist. And the good thing, or I think at least it worked very well when I was playtesting the game, the thing that is that really works well here is that they don't need to decide their gear before they start the adventure. They simply have four slots. They go on adventure. Whenever they need or they feel like they need a piece of equipment, they just fill one of the four slots with that piece of gear. They deduct its value from the budget. So each heist comes with a certain budget. And then, yeah, that's the system. So whenever they run out of slots or money, they don't have access to equipment. If they have slots and budget, they can do it. And it's kind of like it simulates this idea that, you know, crew members are professional. They know what they do. So it's not right. Like, oh, I forgot to bring my gun or whatever. No, it's like they didn't forget to bring anything. They, you know, they just have to have money or budget and space. But you can have whatever you want during the heist. So it's kind of a bit like Blades in the Dark in a way.
It's also interesting in that the inventory, because as you said, there isn't a character creation. You're just kind of given the role that you're playing this trope.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting that like the inventory is almost a bit of character creation because, yeah, you're the Bruiser. What type of Bruiser are you? You don't know when you start, but if midway through the game, you're like, ooh, I need brass knuckles and rope. Now I have a better idea of what type of Bruiser I am rather than like a different game where the Bruiser needs a machine gun. Like it's little flavors, it's little twists of a trope, but it is fun to see like how characters will evolve through this game when you're not given the character creation process early on. Mm-hmm. You find it throughout the game, which I think is really cool.
You find it throughout the game. And that's a very common thing in more narrative and story driven games anyway. It's that, you know, characters are kind of created in their arcs as the game progresses and the fiction progresses. So it kind of also talks to that aspect and that approach to game design, I think.
Mm.
But it also has like the, so it's me doing all these, you know, this thing where role-playing games have like three, I don't know if anybody's paying attention to this theory anymore, but I kind of find it useful that games are defined or are categorized either by being gamist, narrative, or simulationist. I think that's what it is. It's
okay,
called the
sure.
GNS theory or something like that. And so gamist being you're trying to beat the game. So those kind of games where you're trying to win against the game or trying to beat the game. Classic dungeons like Tomb of Horrors, that's normally marked as like a gamist dungeon. And then you have like the simulationist where everything is kind of pre-written and characters simply inhabit a pre-written world, a pre-made world. And they're not expected to come up with innovative or out of character, out of world stuff. For instance, if you're playing a Lord of the Rings game, you're not going to say that you're arriving riding like a mech or whatever,
right,
or in a plane, right? That, it doesn't work. So it's kind of like a simulationist in the way that, and that's how most OSR and old school and traditional games work. And then you have the narrative, which is kind of like emergent fiction. You play to find out. Nothing is predetermined. Not even the setting is predetermined. So if you play games like Apocalypse World, right, there's not a setting for Apocalypse World. The setting is formed as the players play the game. The way I think about the job, it has a bit of all these three elements combined. It's kind of like narrative, as you were saying, because characters kind of discover themselves as the game progresses, and their gear, and it's not pre-written. And when the game starts, there's nothing pre-written. So the players kind of imagine what their own world is going to be like. But it's also gamist in the way that you're actually trying to win
right.
this game, because it has like a winning condition. And it's kind of simulation is also in a way, because it's not completely free form. So actually the referee is going to run a module in a way for you. So it kind of combines aspects of all these different approaches to game design in a way that I think it works.
Getting into a bit of the crowdfunding of this game, which is happening right now as people are listening, where are you funding? What can people get? And why BackerKit over Kickstarter? Because that's always a fun question we like to ask people these days.
So it's funding on BackerKit, as you were saying, under Exalted Funerals account, and you can find the link on, for instance, our website. Just go on our website or Exalted Funerals website. Our website is gamesomnivorous.com and exaltedfuneral.com, and there's a big banner. Just click and you go to the campaign. What we're offering right now is a box set with the book, reusable character sheets with dry erase markers, dice. We're offering the briefing notepad so that the referee can create their own adventures or briefs and give to the players. And then as stretch goals, we have a bunch of adventures and mission envelopes with, you know, stuff like blueprints or brochures or like immersive props alongside with briefings and like fake cash and example plans. We're also offering example plans. So if you receive the box set and you want to skip straight to the action phase, you just have like 1 hour or 1 hour and a half to play and you want to skip right to the action phase, the box set will come with a bunch of sample example plans that you can use for like a quick play mode. In BackerKit, we at Games on Rivers, we shifted to BackerKit last year. Mm-hmm. So our last campaign was already on BackerKit. This was had mostly to do with the fact that Kickstarter, Portugal is where Games on Rivers is based, is not a Kickstarter country. So it's not possible to do campaigns being like a Portuguese company. You cannot officially host a Kickstarter campaign. So what we did in the past is we partner up with Exalted Funeral, and there was, you know, all sorts of a bit of complications here and there when it came to transferring stock and all these like logistical and accounting issues. So BackerKit last year started to include Portugal as a country in their
nice.
You can create, as a Portuguese company, you can create a BackerKit campaign. So that's why we shifted and we moved to BackerKit essentially. And then Exalted, when we started discussing this, Exalted thought that it was a good fit to do the job on BackerKit. And yeah, we like, since we had already shifted to BackerKit anyway, we at Games Omnivorous, it was right. Yeah, it was not an issue. Like, it felt natural.
Hell yeah.
I didn't know that about Kickstarter in Portugal. It's interesting.
Yeah.
I would love to turn a little bit to Games Omnivorous as a whole. For anyone who's listening who doesn't know or isn't familiar with the games that Games Omnivorous publishes, can you tell us what Games Omnivorous publishes, and also kind of what's your overall ethos at Games Omnivorous?
So yeah, so we are in a bit of a repositioning, rebranding, restructuring moment. Currently, in the past, you know, a couple of months, and we are still unsure exactly how everything will fall into place, but we kind of know where we want to go and how we want to be seen moving forward. But up until now, Games Omnivorous was a games publisher, an independent, an indie games publisher. That's what the project was and has been until now, for 5 years. It started 5 years ago. And we are basically known for, I think that people recognize the brand and know us for probably our biggest successes, which are definitely games like Mouse Ritter. I think the sales that we made on Mouse Ritter are like probably bigger than all of the others combined, if, just for you to have an idea. So Miles Ritter is just a, like a global phenomenon. It's incredible. Like
it's a really cool game.
So that I think that people know us mostly for Miles Ritter, but also for like games like Frontier Scum, games like Vaults of Varn, and these supplements like the Undying Sands and the Bottled Sea and the Hex Crawl Toolbox, which we won. Some Annie's last. We won one Annie for the toolbox, and then we were nominated. The Undying Sands was nominated a couple of years back as well.
Nice.
I think that, and these are like system agnostic settings that you can play with games like D&D or OSR games like whatever Knave or Cairn or Into the Odd or Black Hack or Dungeon Crawl Classics, whatever you want to use. And these people, I think people know us for these supplements because they're very different from what normal settings look like. So settings are usually presented, or gaming universes, gaming worlds are usually presented as books, right? You read from a book and then the book tells you the factions or the fauna or the creatures or the landscape or the geography, the demography of the place. Whether in these settings, there's no book. So it's a bunch of modular physical hex tiles that players and the GM draws from a bag, and the gaming map world is created as the players explore it. Mm. And then the settings come with a bunch of, a GM screen with a bunch of descriptions, fairly minimalist descriptions and little pamphlet adventures. So the idea there being, or the challenge there was to create, how to create flavorful and immersive settings, gaming settings, without them being presented as books. So that was kind of like, and I think people know us for mostly these settings and those big hits like Miles Ritter that I was telling you about. But yeah. I think that the core agenda or the driving agenda behind Games Omnivorous, in a way, was to combine or to blur the lines between games and art. In a way, games, yeah, art, literature, music. That's kind of like the driving force. We think of games, or me personally, I think of games as a form of artistic expression. I don't think of games as just mere entertainment. I think that games, and some games, well, obviously there are games which are mostly designed for the sake of entertainment, but there are also games that kind of try to push the boundaries of certain literary genres, for instance, or try to do really cool and immersive things which otherwise wouldn't exist. Games have a particular form, or are a particular form of medium, an art medium, I would say, that is very unique and does something that movies or literature or music doesn't do. But I think they're kind of peers to those forms of art or artistic expression, in my view. It's very similar, I think, to like comic books. If you think about it, comic books started as like juvenile or minor, or a minor form of literature, right? And with the likes of authors like Alan Moore, for instance, they are kind of part of the literary canon at this point, or even part of national identities, right? Which is the case, for instance, with Belgium. And I think that in a way, games are kind of evolving in a similar way, I would say. And there's a certain push within, maybe small now, but getting bigger spheres and people and creators and labels that are trying to kind of push this agenda forward. Folks like the Stockholm Cartel in Sweden, creators, yeah, in lots of creators in the US, in the UK. So I think that this is kind of like how Games Omnivorous started, was to dialogue and help and kind of contribute to this agenda of games as art. So that's to answer your question. So that's how I think, or how I like to think about Games Omnivorous as a project. And then I think that mostly we are known for that, but also for our biggest hits like Miles Ritter and stuff. And now we're kind of like repositioning the brand. We're in a moment of transition, and I think we The idea being we are no longer going to be a publisher per se, but we're mostly going to be, or we are going to shift focus to being a game design studio. So mostly concentrating and focusing on the creative side of things and doing the games and designing the games and overseeing production at some extent, because production and production design and the physical qualities of our stuff is very important to me. But we're going to hand over like the logistics, sales, publishing to other companies and friends and partners, which is the case with Exalted Funeral. The job is being released and published by them. And so it's a Games Omniverse production published by Exalted Funeral.
Yeah, it's one of the things that like Games Omniverse has become synonymous in my mind with beautiful art objects that are games. Like picking up Electric Mangrove is like such a special experience when you open that up and you go, oh, wait a second, there's a dungeon in here, and it's like beautiful colors. Brian's holding up a copy right now for our listening audience. Yep.
Also, in case someone doesn't know what Electric Mangrove is, it's a vinyl with music, and then inside there's also like a dungeon module you can run.
Yeah.
And like Frontier Scum was like the first time I was like, oh, you can make an open spine book. Like, and now I'm making an open spine book with someone we just crowdfunded with Viditya Valetti, A Land Once Magic. So I'm curious, like, because you're obviously a game designer, but you care a lot about production value. How do you think about that relationship when you're designing a game? When does your brain start imagining the beautiful object that the game could be in the stage of creation?
Well, first of all, thanks for the super kind words. But yeah, it's absolutely something that we pay, and me personally, I pay a lot of attention to, is the physicality. I don't know if that's a word, but the physical aspect of holding a book in your hands, or a vinyl, or a box set even, I think that it's very important when you know, the texture of the paper or the cover or how it's presented, the colors, like this is all very important to me. And I think that it was kind of like a learning process for me in a way, because I wasn't very aware of this when I started the company came back 5 years ago. But I was fortunate enough to partner up with what we call our in-house game designers, not game designers, in-house graphic designers here, which are Lina and Nando, which is a couple that lives in the north side of Portugal. And first of all, they're incredible graphic designers, but they have one particular thing that kind of makes them stand out against most people in the gaming industry, is that they don't like games. which is like, I know it's a bit odd to say this, but they're like, I could never sit them down for a game. You know, it's like, it's not going to happen. They are very much into the Portuguese art scenes, literature, theater, poetry. That's where kind of like the scenes they navigate here in Portugal. And I was fortunate enough to convince them to partner up for this for Games Omniverse as a project. And I think they brought a lot of these more minimalist and artistic approach to graphic design, which was something that is not completely new, obviously, in games. I'm not going to revindicate that I invented the wheel or whatever, but it's like they brought something that it was, you know, distinctive enough, I would say, and had its own like visual language, which I find very interesting. So when they tagged along and we partnered up for this project, they were very conscious of the physicality and the physical aspect. When you touch a book, how it's going to feel in your hands, and these kind of aspects, they were very aware of this. So I kind of learned as the project evolved to also be aware of this. And then it's mostly I go to bookstores and museums and stuff, and I'm always paying attention not only to the content they're offering, but how the content is presented. Like if you go to a photography bookstore, you'll come out with at least 10 excellent ideas for how to present your next RPG book. And that's where kind of like the secret is, if there is one. And it's just, we start thinking about a game and how do we kind of make this game stand out a bit more physically? And how does the physicality of the book convey the theme of the book in a way? So you were mentioning Frontier Scum, right? Frontier Scum is a very raw, acid, kind of like not a family-friendly game, you know what I mean? So the book kind of had to convey that idea. So the open spine, it kind of seems like there was one customer, actually, one client that sent an email when we released Frontier Scum. It was like, oh, can you send another copy? My spine is broken. And like, you know,
actually.
It's actually... Yeah, that's exactly how we wanted you to feel, you know what I mean? So that's how we kind of like think of things and approach things. That's what we kind of try to do. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I think honestly that kind of thought that goes into like product design is just so important and so easy to forget when you mm-hmm. put so much time into making a game, you can get so lost in like what's inside the cover and forget that like we do judge books by their cover, and we do we judge things by what they look like. And not only do we judge them, do I want them or do I not want them? There's so much information that is told to you by like the quality and the layout of the box of Mouse Ritter, or like I look at Morkborg and I'm like, because of the cover and because of the quality of it and because of the packaging of things, I already kind of have an idea of what I'm picking up. In the same that we were talking about with The Job, like if you read those acknowledgments of the types of games that it's pulling from and the movies it's pulling from, on the first page I know what is going to be inside, and that's incredibly helpful because then I can go deeper and deeper and deeper and get lost in the game and eventually bring it to a table.
No, that's exactly right. I think you're right. I think that a good blurb, the physical aspect of the book, a good like credits page with a good like bibliography or filmography or whatever, I think that is very important because as a reader, I like to know what I'm getting into without starting the book.
Exactly. You know what I mean? Exactly.
That's where these things come in, basically, is like product design, cover, how you even the marketing side of it, right? That's where everything comes in to help the reader understand exactly what they're getting into before even reading the first line. And I think that's important because obviously, reading the book is perhaps the most important experience, but everything that comes before sets the tone and sets the expectation and sets and puts the reader and the player in the right mindset or to then play and read this the whole thing. So I think it's very important.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Oh, love it. Andre, as we work towards a close, I kind of want to zoom out a little even like further from Games Omnivorous to like you're a Portuguese based company and like you're Portuguese yourself, you've got Portuguese collaborators. Is there a Portuguese RPG scene? What is it like and like how has it influenced maybe your work if you think it has influenced it?
So the scene in Portugal is fairly small, I would say. It's been evolving over the past few years. But just for you to have an idea, I think the first RPG book ever published in Portugal was the Dungeons & Dragons Red Box from the 90s.
Oh, okay.
Sure.
So I think that was the first one that it was translated into Portuguese and published here. So this was like 94 or 93.
Yeah.
And I think that between 93 and 94 and like 2015 or 16, there wasn't a single thing published in Portugal. At least, obviously, there were some like digital and amateur or indie things kind of like circulating in small circles, in gaming groups and gaming stores. But like the idea of actually, you know, releasing, publishing, printing a proper like book or whatever didn't happen until like very late, maybe even like 2020 almost, I would say. When I founded Games Omnivorous, there wasn't really a scene here. So that's why I think I think of the project as being inserted in this more transnational or international circuit or industry rather than, you know, speaking to the Portuguese scene directly, which is very, very small and very minor. I know that today there are people that do Kickstarters in Portugal. There's Newborn Games that is doing a Kickstarter now. And we handle their, we help out with fulfillment. There's a bunch of people doing, but they're all very, you know, very, very, they're small print, local print runs. So it's not a scene that it's expanding, at least the production side of it or the creation side of it. It's still very incipient, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the gaming groups, there's a bunch of people playing now, like board games have exploded in Portugal, and with them, a bit role-playing games too, but people stick to playing like mostly the mainstream titles, like D&D or Pathfinder or Vampire or Call of Cthulhu or Free League games, obviously are very big at this point as well. That's normally what they play. And then there's a Portuguese convention called Rol Lisboa that happens in Lisbon in the fall every year. And it's expanding, it's getting bigger. There's cool people involved. There's interesting speakers. They invited a bunch of game designers from everywhere to speak normally over the internet online. But it's very cool. But it's still small. You know, we're talking about 200 people or give or take. So it's right. it's a scene that it's not well, definitely not huge. And even our sales, like Games Omnivore sales, Portuguese or sales that come from Portugal represent less than, I don't know, 1% of our sales.
Oh, wow.
So it's virtually, it's very small.
Andre, the last question we like to ask on this show is a question we call, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our fun way of asking for a recommendation from you. This could be a recommendation of a game, a person, a TV show, a movie, a book. Could be inside of tabletop, could be outside of tabletop. What is something you would recommend today to our audience that's listening?
One of the best shows that I've ever watched just finished season 2, and it's Severance. I don't know if you saw Severance. And I found myself at some level trying to think what an RPG that kind of like emulates this experience could be like.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that Severance is a fantastic, phenomenal TV show. And I think that there's not any game out there that kind of does what the series does, I would say. So I kind of like, yeah, maybe I would bring Severance to the table because it's so innovative, so cool, very well done. So maybe Severance, I think.
That's great.
We're huge Severance fans here. Love it.
Thank you so much for coming to the table. Do you want to let people know where they can find you online if they're looking for you?
Thank you so much for having me. It was fantastic talking to you both. You're really, really cool to talk to. So thank you so much for that.
Thanks for feeling the same.
Thank you.
You can find us at gamesomnivorous.com. And then we have a Discord community. So you can join our Discord community if you feel like. And you'll find the invite in our homepage. Just scroll down until you see the big Discord logo and click and follow that link. And now we're mostly active in terms of social media in Instagram and Blue Sky. That's mm-hmm. mostly nice. What we're doing these days. Mostly Blue Sky, I would say. But I think that, just if you like what we do and want to hear more and you know, talk to people that also like our games, definitely join our Discord community and you can also join our mailing list in the homepage. So yeah, that's it.
And be sure to go back the job on BackerKit and get in on the heist fund.
Absolutely go back the job on BackerKit.
And of course, if you want more gaming content from us, check out the Many Sided newsletter and the Many Sided Media Discord, where you can talk about this episode and all of the episodes of Talk of the Table. You can support this show on the Many Sided Media Patreon, where you can get ad-free episodes, bonus roundtables, as well as a whole bunch of other fun content for this and our other show, My First Dungeon. Please be sure to rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.